Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us again this month for our Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call is going to be on October 1st, so please go ahead and mark your calendars. And again, thank you for joining us this month. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. I will announce when this Q&A session starts, usually maybe 15 to 20 minutes before the end of our session. So you have a couple of options there. You can either come on live and ask your question to us directly. I will unmute you and have give you the ability to speak to all of us online. Or you can type your question in your questions box if you choose to do so. Please make sure you indicate your name, and I will go ahead and pick first come, first serve. Feel free to start typing those questions in now because I can just read those towards the end of the session. Go ahead and either let me know that you want to come on live or go ahead and submit your question directly in the questions box. All right, so now that we've got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. He's a seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy. He has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, and be sure to check out TRI Tax Tuesdays. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. Every other Tuesday of this month, we have a free webinar on different tax resolution topics. Keep an eye out for our invitations via email for more details. And if you forget when these happen, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we are here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And absolutely, we want to make sure that you guys have the ability to increase your revenue. I do have a quick announcement. We do have our upcoming full-day event on November 14th. That is up on our website and on our course calendar. So if you're interested in attending a full-day seminar, 8 hours of CPE credit available to you, where you can learn to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most, learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. It's coming up on November 14th, the Tax and Tax Resolution Forum. Starts at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern. But for those of you that can't make the live event, we are going to be rebroadcasting this event, and we're breaking it up into 2 days. So the rebroadcast dates are November 19th and 20th, 4 hours each day, in case you can't make the full-day event on November 14th. Again, we will send you out an email indicating more details about this and also a promotion on the event itself. So thank you very much for joining us. And with that said, Norman, let's go ahead and get started here with the questions that we have. Those of you who are new to this practitioners forum, just so you know, the first series of questions that we ask here are directly from VIP members. VIP members do get priority on these calls, so we want to make sure we address all of their questions. And a lot of you responded, some of you more than one, so I'm going to go ahead and make sure that I get those to you. Again, as a VIP member, you do get priority. So our first member here is Ezra. Ezra is an EA, and he's asking, with regards to an in-business offering compromise, can you explain how this would work for a company with payroll tax problems? The company still has not been able to make their estimated tax payments for this year, and continue to struggle. I want to be able to get them clear of their past liabilities so that they don't go under. The IRS revenue officer has already suggested that they do close up shop.
So in business offer and compromise is pretty rare. And unlike offers and compromise of individuals, where the individual can make a choice between a lump sum payment and periodic payments, I believe in business offers and compromise are always periodic payment plans. And so that brings me to the question of periodic payment offer versus an installment agreement, because one of the grounds that the IRS uses to accept or reject offers is comparing the collection ability as opposed to an installment agreement. The other advantage of an installment agreement is that you can stagger the amount, so you can start off with a lower monthly payment with the idea that the business is going to grow and you can increase the payments a year or two down the line. So the first thing I would say is I would compare the offer to an installment agreement to determine which is better. The other thing is that in either an installment agreement or an offer, the IRS is going to strictly look at the company's compliance. And by that, I mean they need to make their federal tax deposits timely. They need to file their 941s timely. They can't owe any additional tax liability for payroll tax. So it's going to be pretty strict. And if they're still struggling to make payroll tax payments, then neither the installment agreement or the offer may help. So the first and most important thing is to make sure that the company stays in current compliance and makes all its federal tax deposits timely. And that's really important because there's a very high penalty for late paid tax deposits. And those penalties can throw you out of an installment agreement or an offer as is considered new liability. So if you think they can make it, go ahead. If you want to send me a copy of the 433B or the 433B OIC and the before you send it in, I'll be glad to review it and determine which is the best way to go and whether or not it needs to be tweaked. But an in-business offer is possible, but the guidelines are very, very narrow and strict, and there's absolutely no room for any non-compliance issues. So if they're ready to get and stay in compliance, then there may be a way to go.
Right. Thank you, Norman. And yeah, Jessica just chimed in. Looks like Jessica was able to get an in-business offer and compromise approved, but she did say it was the lump sum payment option that they gave her.
Okay.
So good job, Jessica, there. Now, one of the things that we also, you know, we're advisors to our clients. And if the taxpayer himself continues to add liability, the revenue officer is justified in asking the question, should the business continue to go on? So how do you advise them, Norman, when it comes to that? And then what kind of determinations do you have?
Yeah, that brings up the other point, too, is that because there's trust fund payroll tax owed, there's going to be a trust fund recovery penalty assessed against the responsible persons. So part of the reason and the calculation of an accepted offer or an installment agreement is is what payments are the responsible persons making towards the trust fund liability. So that's another factor to add in. And another advantage of an installment agreement where it's possible to get the responsible persons not off the hook in the sense of having the trust fund go away, but put in non-collectible while the company is paying off the payroll tax liability. And so even though the responsible person has been assessed a trust fund recovery penalty, it's called status 63, where the IRS won't be looking to the responsible person for any payments towards the payroll or trust fund. You have to take a really good look, because if they're not making payroll, basically what they're doing is they're borrowing from the IRS. They're giving credit to the employees by withholding taxes from their payroll, but not passing it on to the IRS. So I think it's a real indication that there's something wrong with the business. And if it happens quarter after quarter, I think you need to look and see if the company is a viable business or not.
Right. All right. Good luck with that, Ezra. Again, if you need any help, use some of that consultation time that comes with your membership and give us a call. We can help you with reviewing those documents. Next question here is from Clifford. Clifford is also a member in the CPA. And Clifford, you asked a couple questions. So this is the first one that you sent, I believe, a couple weeks ago. Taxpayer has not filed their company's S-Corp for 2016 and 2017 corporate tax returns. Once filed, is there a definitive strategy for disputing the inevitable federal late penalties? So he's suggesting strategy number one: if 2016 penalty is disputed, citing reasonable cause, assuming that the FTA is still available for the 17 tax return, is the consideration for the FTA being granted weakened in the eyes of the IRS? Or strategy two: if 2016 penalty is abated using the first-time penalty abatement, is a reasonable cause argument for the 17 tax return weakened in the eyes of the IRS, since this is the second consecutive tax year that the taxpayer's corporate tax return was filed late?
Okay, so first of all, I don't believe that you could argue reasonable cause for the earlier year, 2016, and then try first-time abatement for 2017, because 17 wouldn't qualify, because it's not that it was abated, it's whether or not it was ever assessed. So I think if you're going to go with a first-time penalty abatement, you have to go with 16, and then you have to look at 3 years prior to 16. So you have to look at 13, 14, and 15 and see if there were any penalties that were assessed for the 3 years prior to 16. The other thing is that first-time penalty abatement is kind of like a wild card. And you really only want, you can only use it once, and you really want to be careful how you use it. And so if you have grounds to request abatement based on reasonable cause, I think that you should start there, because even if reasonable cause is denied, you can then fall back on first time penalty abatement. And you haven't, you know, you haven't used it up. And so the thing is, if 16 and 17 were both filed late for the same reason, I mean, I guess you could make a reasonable cause argument for 16 and 17, but it would have to be based on information or advice that was given by a professional that was negligent, that was, that the taxpayer relied on, but turned out to be unreliable. So I'm not sure of this, of the circumstances, and I'd be glad to go over with you, but I would really need to see what that reasonable cause argument would be and whether or not it stood any chance of sticking or not. So it really would have to be that the taxpayer reasonably relied on advice from a professional that turned out to be incorrect. And when the taxpayer learned that the information was not correct, they did whatever a prudent business person would do standing in their same shoes. So I don't know the facts, but that's the argument on reasonable cause. So it's the reliance has to be reasonable, and the taxpayer had to use prudent business judgment to correct the mistake once it was discovered.
All right, Clifford, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to Jordan, another member, he's asking, I have a client that has not filed returns for more than 3 years. I will be preparing and filing the delinquent returns, and we know he will owe a significant amount. He wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as the collection activity begins. You mentioned that there is a waiting period in order to do this. Was it 180 days from filing?
Yeah, so the short answer is if he files as soon as collection activity begins, the taxes will not be discharged because there's three rules that need to be followed in order to discharge taxes in bankruptcy. And usually when you're talking about discharging taxes, you're talking about a Chapter 7. If you're talking about paying off the liability over 5 years with no interest for general unsecured claim, then it would be a Chapter 13. So the first rule is the three-year rule. And it has, and the bankruptcy has to be more than 3 years from the due date of the return. So I don't know which 3 years this is, but it's 3 years from the due date, including extensions. So for instance, if they owe for 2018 and it's on extension till October of 19, then they won't be dischargeable until after October 15th of 2022. So you have to look at 3 years from the due date of the return, whether or not the return was timely filed or not. Then there's the two-year rule, and it says it has to be more than 2 years after filing of the return. So that really only applies to late filed returns, so that it would have to have been filed more than 2 years. The bankruptcy would have to have been filed more than 2 years after the delinquent return. And if the IRS files a substitute for a return, an SFR, then all bets are off. The 180 days that you refer to is the 180 day rule. And it says that it has to be more than 180 days after assessment. And so that really doesn't kick in on normal timely filed returns. Where it kicks in is usually audit assessments or other assessments that were assessed after the return. And so you have to meet all three rules, three-year, two-year, and 180-day rule to be dischargeable in bankruptcy. But then again, I want to stress this is not the CPA or EA's job to determine what taxes are dischargeable in bankruptcy and which taxes aren't. It's the bankruptcy attorney's job. And so the only advice that an EA or CPA should be giving a client regarding discharging taxes in bankruptcy is your taxes may be dischargeable in bankruptcy. I suggest that you consult with a bankruptcy attorney familiar with discharging taxes and have him determine whether or not your taxes are dischargeable and when.
All right, Jordan, there you go. And if you need some help with that, Norman is a bankruptcy attorney specialized in that area and can help you out with that. Moving on to Jessica. Jessica's asking, I would like to know the steps that should be taken when a client gets a 90-day notice called notice of deficiency. What are the options to appeal a 90-day notice?
So the 90-day notice, the notice of deficiency, the way to respond to a notice of deficiency is to file a petition in U.S. tax court within the 90-day period. If you wait till after the 90 days, the tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the case, and you're pretty much out of luck except for filing an offer doubt as to liability sometime down the road. But a notice of deficiency needs to be responded to within 90 days, and the proper response is by filing a petition with U.S. tax court. And taxpayers can file petitions in U.S. tax court representing themselves, EAs and CPAs, and even attorneys who are not admitted to practice within U.S. tax court cannot file petitions on the taxpayer's behalf. The only person who can file a petition in U.S. tax court on behalf of the taxpayer is somebody who's admitted to practice before a U.S. tax court, like myself.
There you go. And apparently that is a process that only comes around once a year or so, Norman, is it?
No, so the process to be admitted into U.S. tax court is easier if you're an attorney. But if you're not an attorney, if you're an EA or a CPA, and you want to get admitted to practice in U.S. tax court, you need to take a test. And the test, I think, is only administered every 2 years.
Wow.
And the test has a very, very low percentage rate of passing. It's a very difficult test to pass, and a very small percentage of those who take it actually pass the test.
All right. Well, so moving on to the next one. This is Maribel. Maribel's asking, taxpayer tried to negotiate their own installment agreement for a tax liability of about $18,000. The taxpayer offered $300 a month, but the IRS denied the request and wants $1,500. There's no way the taxpayer can afford that. Why would the IRS deny this request? I read on your site about the streamlined installment agreement rules, and it says the IRS will accept if the amount is less than $25,000.
Right. So God bless the taxpayers who try to do things on their own and then come to us and make matters worse. So I'm not sure what they did, but it could be a couple things. First of all, a streamlined installment agreement is the liability divided by 72 months. So if they owed $18,000, you divide that by 72, you come up with about $250 a month. So if they were requesting a streamlined installment agreement, it should have been accepted, except it doesn't say here what year or years the tax liability is for. So if there's less than 72 months left on the collection statute, then they don't qualify for a streamline like that. And so the $1,500 a month may have been determined by how much they need to pay every month in order to pay the liability in full before the collection statute expires. Or they could have called with like a 433F and given financial information and asked for an installment agreement. And based on their financial information, it was determined that they could afford to pay $1,500 a month. But the whole thing with a streamline is you don't have to give any financial information if the taxes will be paid off in the streamlined installment agreement within the 72 months. So I'm not sure what they did, and you're correct, except this is a different situation, and I'm not sure why. But the thing is, even if the collection statute is about to expire, if they submitted a 433F that showed they only had $300 a month disposable income, then the IRS would have set them up into what's called a partial pay installment agreement, which means that they make the payments every month until the collection statute expires. And at that point, the tax becomes uncollectible. The balance is forgiven, and they're done. And so I would first find out what's going on here, and then the proper remedy would either be a streamlined installment agreement, a partial pay installment agreement, or something like that. And you could probably set them up into something they can live with. But if they can't afford the $1,500 a month, I'm not sure where that's coming from, if it's coming from their financial information or from the time left on the collection statute. So you need to find that out.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that. Maribel, give us a call if any questions come up on that. Moving on to Luke. Luke is asking a question. What is the likelihood of a client getting an offer in compromise if he has already agreed to an installment agreement, but now realized that he was not thinking when he agreed to it with the IRS on the phone?
Yeah, so there's two issues. One is an installment agreement doesn't take into consideration the value of their assets. And so if they're a candidate for an offer or not, I can't tell you because I don't know what the value of their assets is, what equity they have, if they have any in a home or cars or pension plans. And so one thing you need to look at is their assets. The other thing is, if they've already agreed to an installment plan, I don't know if it's a full pay or partial pay, but just look at the amount that they're paying in the installment agreement. And again, I don't know if it was a streamline or if it was based on financials that they submitted. But if it was based on their financials, then you would have to assume that that's the disposable income, and you'd have to multiply you'd have to multiply that by 12 to come up with a minimum offer. And it could be more depending on how much is left of the collection statute. But the short answer is an offer could be submitted while there's an installment agreement, but you're pretty much going to have to go with the amount of the monthly payment as disposable income, and then add on to that value of assets, etc.
All right. There you go, Luke. Yes, so you can modify it and you can submit it, but it all depends on the individual.
And again, if you want me to review it, I'll be more than glad to review the 433A OIC and then whatever financials they submitted in order to get the installment agreement.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Just before we continue on, guys, just want to make sure that we do a quick plug here for our VIP membership. For those of you that are interested in making sure that you get your questions answered during the Practitioners Forum, sign up for our VIP membership. That includes that as one of the perks, but on top of that, there's many more benefits to becoming a VIP member, including getting free access to webinars and seminars, e-learning courses, and just as important, you get consultation time with one of our professionals, including Norman, to address any tax-related question, tax resolution-related question, if you want us to do document review, put together a strategy for you, anything that you may need to be able to help you get through a particular case that you're going through and make sure that you're successful, we can help guide you with that. And again, the consultation time is available for that. As a special offer that we make for those of you who attend the practitioners forum, we want to make sure we extend a 2-month free trial to you. So please go ahead and click on the link that I'm sending you now if you're interested in signing up for the VIP membership. Thank you all, and let's go ahead and keep going, Norman. Next question from another member is coming from Jason. Jason is asking, I have a doctor who has not filed personal income tax returns in 5 years. In addition to his tax payments, he'll have penalties and interest. Returns are not completed yet. Can I select the single year with the greatest penalty amount to apply for the first-time waiver?
The answer is no.
The answer is no, correct.
Because first-time penalty abatement, you have to, in order to qualify, you can't have incurred penalties 3 years prior to that year. And so if you pick a later year, then you're automatically not qualified for first-time penalty abatement because you owe for the earliest year. So I would look at the earliest year. So I'm not sure if you're filing 13 through 18, or, but if you are, then you'd have to look at 10, 11, and 12 to see if they qualify for first-time penalty abatement for 13, for the earliest year. The other option is penalty abatement based on reasonable cause. If there's a reasonable cause why he hasn't filed for 5 years, then you might try that. But first-time penalty abatement is only based on the earliest year.
All right. And we went into more detail a little bit earlier ago, but Jason, give us a call if you need further clarification. Moving on to Roger. When preparing an OIC, the only asset the client has is an IRA account, approximately $50,000, which is his only source of retirement. The taxpayer is 63 years old. Can that amount be excluded based on hardship? What is the best way to handle this problem?
Yeah, so he doesn't receive Social Security. But to answer your question, there's three kinds of offers. The normal one is based on ability to pay or inability to pay. And at that time, they would look at this and see what the liquidation value of the IRA is, what he could borrow on or what he could pull out. So you don't want to go there. And then the second is doubt as to liability. And you don't want to go there because I don't see any indication that he disputes the liability. So the third is called effective administration.
Tax administration.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Effective tax administration.
Effective tax administration. And what that means is exactly this, that there's some hardship or grounds where normally the asset would be considered in determining the offer amount. But in this case, it would be a hardship too. And so they don't. Sometimes it's like if a taxpayer has equity in their home, but because they've been living there so long and their mortgage payment is so low, or maybe they don't even have a mortgage payment, they're allowed to live there because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. So that kind of like this, if the IRA is absolutely necessary for his retirement, but what it doesn't say here is he retired now, or is he, you know, plan on retiring 10 years from now? And so you still have to look at his other assets, although you say it's his only asset. But what about disposable income? You'd have to look at his income and his allowable expenses. So it doesn't really say whether or not he's using the IRA at this point, whether or not it's his only source of income at this point, or whether it's going to be his only source of income in the future. So I would need to see that. But to answer your question, yes, there is a type of offer that would allow someone to keep an asset that has equity in it for hardship purposes.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Clifford. This is your second question that was just received recently. Clifford is asking, joint filing taxpayers will be filing their 2017 personal tax return by 9/15/19, so presumably late there. Projected to owe over $200,000, including penalties and interest. The expanded streamline installment agreement is the only plan available for up to $100,000, but this includes penalties and interest, correct? Prior streamline installment offered in prior years were for just tax liabilities, not penalties and interest, but they are no longer available. So he's asking whether that's...
So yeah, let's answer each question at a time. So the first question is, as far as I know, it's still only the tax that adds up to the $100,000. I've done this pretty recently. But if they owe more than $200,000, I would think that the majority of that would be tax. And so you can call the practitioner priority line or something and ask them, or regular ACS, and ask them how much they would have to pay down in order to qualify for the expanded streamline, and they'll give you amounts because they want you to apply it to the earliest years first. By that I mean the years that the collection statute is going to expire first. And so if they needed to pay $50,000, let's say, to get it down, then they would tell them also which years to apply the $50,000. It could be divided into two or three years, depending how much they owe for each year. And it's not necessarily the earliest year. It's the earliest assessed year. So there could have been an audit assessment, or there could have been a return filed later, whatever. And so don't assume that it's the earliest year is the year with the most recent a collection statute expiration. It's not necessarily so. So you can, the best way to determine that is just to call and ask them, and they'll do the calculation, and they'll tell you exactly what needs to be paid, what years it needs to be applied to, and what the deadline is to pay it in order to qualify for the extended streamline.
Okay, so the next question is, with their 2018 tax return due on October 15th and with another balance of at least $50,000, is it possible to get the streamline installment agreement accepted for all tax years through 17, not 18, before the 2018 return is considered late? Of course, this is assuming they pay down the total pre-2018 tax liabilities to $99,999.
So do you understand this? I think what you're saying is, okay, so if you do it, if you do an extended streamline for 2017 and earlier, and then you file 18 and you owe, it's going to default the installment agreement. If you want to include 2018 in the mix, then I would file 2018. You know, there's just because the due date has been extended to October 15th doesn't mean you have to wait till October 15th. So if you're concerned about timing, you could always prepare it now and file it now and include 2018 in the extended streamline. But again, you're going to have to get the total down below 100,000. Now the third option is you call now and you say and you find out what you need to pay it down in order to qualify, and you do that and you qualify, Then when you file 2018, you have to pay it in full with the return. But what you have to remember is the extension was was an extension to file, not an extension to pay. And so you have to figure that if you file your return on or before October 15th, you're going to have, you won't have a late filing penalty, but you'll have a late payment penalty. And so you should figure out what the late payment penalty is going to be and what the interest is going to be and make the payment so that 2018 is paid tax, penalty, and interest in full, so there's no liability whatever in 2018. Because if you file the return and just pay the tax, you're going to get a notice that you owe penalties and interest, and that's going to be a breach, and you're going to be back where you started from.
And what Cliff is saying here, Norman, is that he's wanting not to fully disclose financials. So he is in that predicament where he needs to be able to pay large sums to be able to keep it under.
Then what you can do is you can do it now, and they're going to ask you, well, what about 2018? And what you say is the taxpayer is going to borrow money and is going to full pay 2018 when they file the return, that they're going to full pay tax, penalty, and interest of 2018 with the return, which will be filed on or before October 15th, and they're going to be borrowing the money in order to do that. And the reason I say that is because you don't want them, you're trying to avoid financial disclosure, so you don't want them to know that they're sitting on a pile of money.
Right. All right, Cliff, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to the next question here is Jeremy. Actually, before I go into Jeremy, for those of you on the line, if you want to go ahead and submit your questions online now, you can. There's a couple already pending here, but we do have a lot of questions to get through here. So
I just want to say to Cliff, if you have any questions, give me a call.
Yeah. All right, so go ahead and start submitting those questions online now. We'll do our best to get to them, but we do have about 15 minutes left. We want to make sure we get to as many as we can. So Jeremy is asking, client had an audit for tax year 2017 and ignored the notices. She has now received collection notices for tax due, and it looks like an NIL was issued, and not sure if we can appeal the audit now. Looking at the original request for information, it seems like we can approve at least some of the expenses they were looking at. What are my options?
Yeah, so if it's too late to file a tax court petition, which I think it probably is, because I think there's a 90-day hold on collection while you have the ability to file a tax court petition to dispute the audit. So I think your option now is to file an offer doubt as to liability and include in that offer a draft return of how it should look, and along with the expenses that they didn't allow that you're disputing. So you want to include some kind of invoice or statement for the expense and a cancel check or something to prove that the expense was paid, and a short explanation of why the expense was necessary.
All right, moving on to the next question here is from Dana. Dana's asking, I posed a question last month, which was that I had an IRS audit for 16 completed in March 27th. The audit then had to go to IRS upper management for review and approval. I hadn't heard anything in all this time when I asked the question. Last week, I received a copy of the IRS letter to the taxpayer that IRS had added a tax liability to their existing installment agreement. I assume this means that the 2016 audit is completed, as IRS would not add a balance for 2016 until the audit was done. Am I correct?
I know that seems really weird, because if you have an audit, you have a couple times during the audit a chance to dispute it. You have the 30-day letter to the auditor, and then you have the 90-day letter to petition the tax court. So it seems kind of odd that they're audited and then all of a sudden the amount is finalized and added to their installment agreement, without any opportunity to dispute the audit. That doesn't sound right. Maybe do they owe based on the return? And so was the 16 liability that was added to the installment agreement based on the return and not their audit? I don't know. I don't think it says whether or not you agree with the audit or not, but if you do, and it's been added to the installment agreement without increasing your monthly payment, I guess that's not such a bad deal. But it doesn't sound right to me that that the liability would be finalized without first having at least two opportunities to dispute it.
Right. It sounds like she may be in default of her installment agreement because of added liability. But in any case, Dana, the quick way to see this is pulling that transcript. Pull your 2016 transcript and see what activity happened. Okay, moving on to Gary. Gary says, a client received an ASFR notice for the 2016 1040 return, but had also not filed 2015. 2015 was filed about a week before 2016. However, IRS processed the 2016 return before the 2015 return. Client requested that credit from 15 roll forward to 2016, then to 2017 as taxes are owed for 2017. Instead of crediting the overpayment to 2016, IRS issued a refund for 2015. Is there a way to use the 2015 refund to apply to the 2017 taxes? The refund has not been deposited.
Okay, so what it seems to me, maybe I'm misreading this, is that they received a refund check in the mail that they haven't cashed it yet, that they wanted it to be applied to whatever. So why couldn't they just cash the refund check and write a check to the IRS or make a payment online to the IRS wherever they want that refund applied?
Yeah, it seems like Gary was trying to have them automatically apply the overpayment. But when that didn't happen, Gary, yeah, your option is just go ahead and cash the check and have the taxpayer pay directly online and have it applied to the year that at that point you have whatever you choose year you wanted to apply it to.
Right. You can then you just make a voluntary payment and you can apply it wherever you want.
Okay, moving on to Juliet. Juliet is asking, I filed an OIC data to liability in March due to identity theft covering years 15 and 16. IRS says they are investigating. Client just got a letter, LT-11, which is intent to seize your property. I thought that all collections were on hold until the OIC got accepted or rejected. Am I wrong? What's the next step?
Right. So an offer submitted in good faith stays collection. So it seems like this might just be one computer not speaking to the other computer. So what I think I would do is order an account transcript and make sure that the offer was received and it shows that it was received on the transcript and for which year. And then I would call ACS with the notice and saying, here's a notice to collect on a year with a pending installment agreement. And they'll look at it and they should say, never mind.
Yeah, and it's also very important to make sure that your offer includes all years that are owed. So part of our process is before we submit an offer, as we run full transcripts for a big span of years, to make sure we're covering everything. Because what could happen here, Norman, is if that tax year is not included in the offer, that's still subject to collection, and they'll send out notices for that.
Right, so that's why I say look at the transcript. Right. So if the year that the notice is for, year or years, that those years have pending installment agreements, you're okay. If not, then maybe it's either a mistake by the IRS or a mistake on preparing the OIC that didn't include all the years with liabilities.
And that's easily rectified. So if you need any help with that, Julie, let us know.
Right.
Moving on to Judith. Judith is asking, I have a client that withdrew a Roth IRA early. Does the entire IRA withdrawal get taxed or just the earnings? Now, from our experience, the Roth IRA are after-tax dollars that get contributed to this IRA plan. So anything that is earned or withdrawn is tax-free. But there are a couple limitations to that. First of all, depending on the taxpayer's age, if they're under 59 and a half, then the earnings, not the contributed amount, but the earnings on that Roth IRA can be taxed and include a 10% penalty. The contribution amount, that's still tax-free, so that shouldn't be an issue. If you're over 59 and a half, the entire balance is able to be distributed without any penalties or tax. The other rule to take into consideration there is just make sure that that Roth IRA plan has been in existence for 5 years. If not, all these things change. But hopefully that helped you there, Judith. Now, we have 10 minutes left, so let's try to get to the rest of these, Norman. Next one is Christy. Christy's asking, I have a client undergoing a 2016 tax form related correspondence audit. The client was very aggressive in claiming expenses based on the industry they work in. How do I present the case to the auditor so that the client is not hit with fraud penalties and then open any additional periods?
Yes, I think what they're looking at are three things. So like I said before, first of all, for every expense, you need some kind of statement or invoice showing the expense. Then you need something like a cancel check to show that the invoice was paid. And then you needed some explanation on why whatever the expense was necessary for the business. And the fraud penalty is an accuracy related penalty of 20%. And so, yeah, you want to avoid that if you can. And I think it only kicks in if it's more than 5,000 discrepancy. So you just have to, in the explanation, let the auditor know that in that industry, it's a reasonable and necessary expense.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be tricky waters to navigate there, Christy. So if you need some help with Norman or someone, other professionals of ours, let us know. Moving on to Melanie. Melanie is asking, what happens to the lien placed on an elderly person's home when he dies? His son will inherit the home. He was giving a CNC, and he, I think, it's the elderly parent.
Yeah, so what happens is, part of the inheritance process, at least in California, it goes to probate. And in probate, the IRS is going to file a claim for its lien, and they're going to have a secured interest, and they're going to get paid through escrow and through probate.
That's what's to be expected.
Yeah.
All right. A quick question here, Norman, is from Mark. Mark is asking, is first-time penalty abatement available for 1120Ss or S-corporations?
Failure to file?
Yeah, failure to file, failure to pay are the two.
It may be because I'm thinking I've been successful under reasonable cause. And how they relied on their CPA or whatever. So I would give it a try again. What I would do is call ACS and ask them, because they have it on their computer and they could just put it in and see whether or not they qualify. A lot of times people have had prior penalties that they didn't tell you about. Oops. You know, late file or late pay, and so they're disqualified. But then again, I always think that first-time penalty abatement program should be used as your second choice, not your first. You should always try reasonable cause first. And if you're denied reasonable cause, then use first-time penalty abatement. But I wouldn't start off with first-time penalty abatement unless you have no reasonable cause argument at all.
Speaking of reasonable cause, and penalty abatement seems to be the hot topic today, Norman. Ann is asking, we have recently discovered the IRS has not received my client's 1120S from 2013, even though she has copied the return with a letter from her CPA that the return would be e-filed. The CPA says the return was rejected, but with no reason, and they will not give her any other information. Is there a reasonable cause or other reason for waiver that we can give, or we can mail it in for first time?
Yeah.
Looks like FTP is not available.
So believe it or not, there's a real discrepancy here because, you know, individuals can't e-file. They have to e-file through
provider. Yeah.
Through providers. Mm-hmm. And so this comes up all the time. Is it a reasonable cause if your provider told you that they e-filed it and didn't look or check or whatever, didn't realize that the e-filing was rejected, and then by the time he finds out and instructs the taxpayer that there's a failure to file penalty. I have been successful in claiming reasonable cause under that scenario and getting the penalty abated. Although the IRS says that that's not grounds, nonetheless, I have made that argument and it has worked.
All right, so go ahead and give it a shot, Anne. Let's see if it works for you. Jessica is asking, is a partial pay installment agreement always reviewed every 2 years for potential revised ability to pay?
It's subject to, but it isn't always. Just like currently non-collectible. It's a temporary thing, partial pay, but I wouldn't use that as a reason for not trying. But it is subject to review, but my experience is it doesn't always get reviewed.
All right, and I think we have time for one last one here, Norman. This is from Edward. Edward is asking, I submitted an OIC for a client. Everything was going well considering the client has no assets to speak of. He's currently on CNC. I used the national standard for all expense items. Item 36, housing utilities, was claimed as 2428 for 2017 and 2428 for 2019. If either of these numbers use the total living expenses, will be below the total income, about $100. So he's saying disposable after these standards are about $100 a month. However, the examiner used $312 as housing utilities without any justification. And when discussed, he indicated that such expenses are not shown in the bank statements provided, and he did not provide any real justification as to why he did not use the standard value. So he said, I wanted him to reject the offer so I can go through appeals. His immediate reaction is that the appeal will come to the same decision. So he has questions about that.
Yeah, so there's two things. First of all is when it comes to housing and utilities, what's allowed is actual up to the standard. And so you could have a situation where your housing and utilities is less than the standard, and they're not going to allow you the full standard if your actual housing and utilities is less. And so the difference might be that the actual housing utility expense is less than the national standard or local standard. And so they went by actual and not the standard. That's correct. As to it going to the offer specialist, the process of appealing a rejected offer is you send it to the offer specialist. They look at it. Theoretically, they could change their mind and agree with you, but it very seldom happens. And so they usually stick to their guns, and then they forward it over to appeals office. So don't worry, even if the offer specialist doesn't agree with you, that's not the end of the appeal process. They're obligated to send it to the appeals office, and you will have a chance to make your argument before a neutral third person. But I just want to give you a heads up that if your argument is that they're not allowing the standard, that's correct, because they're allowing the actual, which is less than the standard.
Yes, you have to be prepared in appeals to be able to substantiate that expense. So in other words, if it's not being paid through the bank statement and their expenses are actually more, how are they paying for it? Are they paying it in cash? Do they have receipts? Is it money orders or cashier's checks that are being issued? Can you get copies of those canceled checks? All of these things can be used as opposed to just the bank statements. And Ed, this is what you're encountering now. So you have
to some expenses don't require documentation, like food and clothing and car expense. You're allowed the standard expense. But when it comes to housing and utility, it's based on, you have to prove actual expense. You're not automatically allowed to the national standard.
All right, there you go, guys, and that's going to do it for this month's Practitioners Forum. I thank you all for submitting your questions ahead of time, and for those of you that submitted online, there are a few questions that we did not get to, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to push these forward to next month. If you need it answered before then, make sure you reach out to me, joe@ssttax.com, with any further questions. Again, take advantage of our VIP membership. And take advantage of the 2-month free trial that we're offering those of you who have attended. Check the chat box. I went ahead and pushed the link. Also, don't forget our upcoming event on November 14th, full-day event, including 8 hours of CPE credit, and with the rebroadcast for those of you that can't make it on November 14th. Check out our website at taxresolutioninstitute.org for further details. Thank you all again, and we look forward to seeing you on October 1st for October's Practitioners Forum. Thank you all. Have a great day.